Chapter 14. Take the Long Way Home. You never realize how much a place has imprinted itself on you until you travel away from it. It was summer, and I had to fly to the United States. My main reason was business, but then I also took the trip as an opportunity to visit family and friends. In Arizona, on my way to visit my friend Michael, I found myself at an intersection, and looking up at a traffic light, I thought, there's a factory in Guangdong that makes those things. I had left China, but it was with me still. My friend Michael and his wife kept four dogs that ran in a pack around their ranch home. As I walked through the door, they jumped up on me. Looking at a fancy collar on one of the dogs, I was reminded of another factory owner in Guangzhou, one who had a thriving business making pet clothing for the export market. Michael and I had known each other since high school, some 25 years ago. We sat in his living room, and everything seemed different to me now. My friend was still my friend, but his home looked more like a showcase of products quite likely made in China. The clock on the wall looked like the sort that was made in China, as did a ceramic vase on a table next to the sofa. Who knew what items in this home had come from China? The majority? They had recently purchased an entertainment center. I looked at it, wondering how many would fit in a 40-foot container. On these infrequent visits, we rarely spoke about my life in China, but Michael had a newfound interest. The U.S. economy was shaky, and China was growing strong. He had no idea what it was like in the Far East, and he admitted that he was curious. China was not a source of enthusiasm for his wife, however. "We keep seeing China on the news these days," she said, as though she wished the media would cover other topics instead. China sounded far off, and knowing that I lived there did not exactly put me in her favor. The conversation shifted. We talked about other things, what some mutual acquaintances were up to, and a recent home improvement project of theirs. Michael went into the kitchen to get drinks, and his wife, Elizabeth, perhaps felt obliged to talk about China. She had always said that she did not understand why I lived there. Now, she said she wanted to ask me something. "Do they really eat dogs?" "I haven't," I said. "You don't, but they do." It was a comment meant as an excuse for not exploring a topic. The media was in part to blame for confounding Americans and for turning them off on the subject of China. On the one hand, news outlets depicted the country as a capitalist nation, but then those same media organizations pounded away at the idea of China as a communist stalwart. There were too many contradictory images. The economy was on fire, implying an imminent threat to America's lead in the global economy, but then the place was still also portrayed as poor and pitiable. China was mysterious and exotic, a land of history and culture, but at the same time, it was shown to be an industrial wasteland. Americans were confused. They didn't know whether to imagine pandas and pagodas or environmental decay and pollution. China's government was totalitarian and overbearing, and yet the media also reported that the Chinese people were among the most contented in the world. Had the Communist Party succeeded in building its harmonious society, or were its citizens suffering from a mass-scale Stockholm syndrome? Not sure what to think, Americans like Elizabeth steered clear of the subject altogether. Michael was more curious than his wife about China. To him, the economy's rapid economic growth sounded impressive, though maybe a bit frightening also. China was growing fast. Surely the country would, in his words, take over the world. "China's really growing, isn't it?" he asked. "It's all right," I said. The growth was certainly there, but just as the Chinese did not blather on about how fast the place was changing, neither did I feel any need to do so. What the manufacturing sector was doing was certainly impressive, but China also had its shortcomings. At one time, China had a reputation for innovation, having invented paper, gunpowder, and the compass, but in more recent centuries, that spark of discovery was replaced by an instinct for copying, not just technologies, but also entire business models. This replaced habit had enabled the country to play catch-up in recent years, but the model was surely not sustainable. No economy could ever win the race by merely catching the wind off another's sail, and China had big ambitions for itself. It was looking not only to lessen the gap between itself and the world, but also to reach parity and surpass industrialized economies like the United States and Japan. And then there were all of the other aspects, too many to go into in one sitting. The business sector had serious ethical issues. Problems with quality control were merely one sign. Michael considered my comments and wanted something less elliptical. Working in the manufacturing sector surely must have provided me with some sense of what was going on generally, and if I did not believe in the boom, then what did I believe about China exactly? Michael was my friend. He didn't want me to run out statistics. He wanted an impression, some kind of final word. He wanted to know where I stood on things, and hoped that I would make the sort of comment that we could tuck away and later recall in a future conversation. "You think that China is going to crash," Michael said, trying to put words in my mouth. "I didn't say that." He kept pressing the point, playing with some of the ideas that I had been bouncing around. As far as he was concerned, it had to be just as others insisted, that China would either rise like a balloon or sink like a stone in a pond. He took my criticisms as a suggestion that I predicted the latter. "The rise and fall of China," he said, trying to play with the common theme. "More like the rise and stall," I said. There were many reasons for me to be in the United States this time. One was to attend a trade show. I was also there to meet with a few U.S. companies that were exploring their options in China. One stop brought me to the town of Waterbury, Connecticut, to a manufacturer of metal components. Having arrived at their offices on the early side, I was asked to sit in a small conference room and wait. I noticed a picture hanging on the wall. It was an old black-and-white photograph taken sometime in the late 19th century. The plant workers stood in front of the factory, which made buckles. The men were all dressed in suits, and the women in the photo wore billowy light-colored dresses. Everyone wore a hat, I noticed, and for good measure, they had even brought the company's horse into the shot. This company had been one of New England's preeminent manufacturers. A couple of corporate mergers, and a century and a half later, the business was a subsidiary of a publicly traded company, and they were scrambling to put together their plan for competing against cheaper parts being made in China by their competitors. Their solution, which was not a bad one at all, was to make use of the same low-cost labor. Not all of the companies that I visited turned into clients, and I kept this in mind whenever traveling afar and on my own nickel. This particular company was looking for general advice only. Mostly, they wanted to know where they might get it wrong if they went to China. They had me do most of the talking while everyone else took notes. Heading out of town after our meeting, I passed other factories, and one in particular looked much like the buckle company that I had just left. From the road, I could not tell what this one produced, and I wondered, what if I stopped at this factory as I had in China? There was enough time in my day, and knowing that I might never be this way again, I decided to turn off on the small state road into the parking lot. "I'm sorry, who are you?" the company's receptionist asked me. After explaining that I had just been to a manufacturer up the road, she considered me carefully and pressed me for further details. "I work in China," I said, and at this one word, China, she squared her shoulders, making herself look like a barroom bouncer. She said that without an appointment, I couldn't meet with anyone. She was not rude, but curt, and I was embarrassed. Whatever was I thinking to drop in on a company like that? Where did I think I was? Foshan or someplace? Apologizing for the interruption, I prepared a quick retreat. Perhaps realizing that she had been short with me, the receptionist softened, and just before I turned to leave, she leaned toward me as if she were going to tell me a secret. "You know," she said, now sounding sweet, "China's actually our competition." Getting into my rented car and pulling out of the parking lot, I realized that I never found out what the company manufactured, and then I thought, what a ridiculous thing to say, China's our competition. If the company was facing hard times because of China, all the more reason to meet and discuss the opportunities. The buckle company had competitors overseas, and its answer was to try and make the place work for them also. Whoever managed to beat their competitors by running away from them? It was a missed opportunity, that was all. On the road to New York, I thought about the ancient Greeks, who had a custom of never turning away travelers. If you found a stranger on your doorstep, you were expected to take the person in, feed him, and allow the person the opportunity to rest. And under no circumstances would a host ever allow such a guest to leave without gifts. One reason for the custom was practical. Long-distance travelers who turned up often carried information from afar. This unique custom was how the ancient Greeks got their news. How many times had I dropped in on a Chinese company and been treated not as a stranger, but as an honored guest? Manufacturers that did not know or expect me would take me in and treat me kindly, and I was not allowed to leave without carrying away gifts, In their case, some of the factory's production samples were forced onto me. While it sometimes felt like I was being used, at least you could respect these industrialists for their forthrightness and savvy. Maybe it was my changed perspective from having lived in China for so long, but it seemed that Chinese companies were more aggressive in engaging the broader world. In the United States, the growing trend was to ignore a rival, when a better strategy might have been to take the threat of competition as a welcome challenge. There was something about China's economic rise in any event that was causing American companies to lose confidence. After a full day meeting with Bernie and his Johnson Carter partners near Broadway in Manhattan, I spent my final 2 days in Philadelphia. I had friends to catch up with there, and it was also a chance to visit a city that I had come to know well during my graduate school days. Summer was the best time to visit, and tourists from around the country filled the streets. Visiting the area around Independence Hall, I noticed a number of changes. A new building for the Liberty Bell had been constructed, along with a spacious visitor center. Sitting on a corner nearby, I spotted an odd figure, a lone protester. It was the first time I had ever noticed a protester in this part of the city, and even more unusual was that the woman's microphone was blaring an announcement in Mandarin. I went closer and noticed that she was protesting on behalf of Falun Gong, the religion in China that was considered a cult by the government and was outlawed as a result. At the other end of the lawn, I spotted two men, also Chinese, whose knockoff Ray-Ban glasses and striped slacks gave them away as possibly being from northern China. I got close enough to hear them speaking in a familiar foreign language, and I said, "Ni hao," just as I might in China. They were glad to talk with me because neither of them spoke English, and I was even more pleased, since it was my first real chance in 2 weeks to speak in Mandarin. Chinese were a generally chatty people, and I was also comforted to reprise my role as Lao Wai, the foreigner who lives in China. Seeing them reminded me of China. I not only missed the place, but also my work. My time in export manufacturing was difficult and even frustrating, but still, I did enjoy it. "Find a wall that you can bang your head against," went the words of one well-known artist, and if you accomplish nothing more than making a small crack in that wall, at least you can say, "That's my wall." I didn't know how much of an impact I was having on the manufacturing sector, but I was used to a certain feeling. I asked the two Chinese that I met about their impressions of America, and they gave me the common complaint about how the Chinese food in the United States is so bad as to be inedible. "What about a cheesesteak?" I asked. We were, after all, in Philadelphia. As bad as they thought their next Chinese meal was going to be, they said that they preferred to stick with what they already knew. They did want recommendations for sightseeing, though. Benjamin Franklin's grave was worth a look, I told them, and I explained why. Because American tourists threw coins onto his grave. Chinese, who have a great reference for savings and an abhorrence for waste, had a hard time believing that real money was left on anyone's tombstone. One of them asked if I meant fake paper money, the sort burned in an offering to Buddha. No, I assured them, it was cash. Why would they do that? I tried to explain the irony in it all. For the man who had famously, and in vain apparently, taught Americans the value of saving by suggesting that a penny saved is a penny earned, tourists from around the country emptied their pockets of spare change, chucking it away. I sent the pair west while I headed south, stopping in a small pizza shop in South Philly. Signs on the walls advised customers against asking for such things as plastic utensils, Parmesan cheese, access to a bathroom, or free water. On the wall, along with these numerous warnings, was one sign that summed up the shop's overall attitude towards customer service. The answer is no, no, no. It was something else that would have been lost on most Chinese visitors, and like Ben Franklin's coin-strewn grave, I found the notices in the pizza shop funny, but sad. The man who rang me up at the register had tattoos. One caught my eye. It was a Chinese character printed in dark blue ink, and it covered half the left side of his neck. It happened to be a character that I recognized, Jiao, which could mean education, or it could be used as a verb as in to teach. I asked whether he was a teacher, and I had to point at my own neck for him to get the reference. "Nah," he said, "it was a mistake. I told the guy I wanted the symbol for hope." In addition to economic troubles, Philadelphia had for the longest time been fighting a major crime wave, and one thing that the city seemed in short supply of was hope. When reporting on violent crime, city newspapers referenced over 400 murders in the previous year, most of them attributed to handguns. China did not suffer from crime to any extent near that, and as a foreigner living in China, I always felt especially safe. Wrapping up my visit to Philadelphia, I saw a t-shirt in a shop window. It had been designed to look like a baseball jersey. The shirt read, "Killadelphia." Living in China, I never saw such things. The Chinese did not have violent crime to such an extent, and they certainly had not got to the point where they made commercial humor out of it. After 2 weeks in the United States, I was more than ready to get back to China. While boarding my flight at JFK Airport, I noticed that the majority of passengers on my flight were Asian, and I already felt closer to my destination. The man next to me was delighted that we could speak in Mandarin, and he asked me, "Where are you heading?" "Woyao huiguo," I told him in a manner that was meant to be tongue-in-cheek. The man's face twisted in a sour expression, and he told me that I could not use those words. He had taken exception to my use of the word huiguo, a verb made up of two characters, hui meant to return, and guo meant country. Put together, the two characters suggested a return to one's homeland. I was effectively declaring domicile. I was calling China my home. "It is not a suitable phrase for you," he said, sounding authoritative and certain. "You are a foreigner. You should simply say that you are traveling to China." He was trying to sound polite, but it felt like a slap in the face all the same. "But I live in China," I said, trying to correct this notion that I was a mere traveler. "I live in Guangzhou." I thought that by naming the city it would help, and it occurred to me to show him the keychain in my pocket, if only to make a further point. All of the keys that I had opened doors in South China. I had almost no physical ties to the United States, and if I didn't live somewhere in America, where had I been all these years? The man squinted, pretending to give some thought to my point of clarification, but he was resolute. "While that may be the case," he said, leaving his final words hanging in the air. He was harsh, yet I recognized the attitude as an oddly familiar one. There were many others in China who shared the same chilly attitude regarding their foreign guests, and it was a reminder to me that while I no longer had a home in the United States, China was holding me at arm's length. There was a parable from ancient China referred to as Han Dan Shui Bu. It was a story about a man who learned of a people in a distant province that had a special way of walking. The man determined that he would go to this other place and learn their gait, which seemed so much more sophisticated than that of his own ancestors. He spent all of his money and invested a great deal of time to get it right, but he was never quite able to pull it off. He never learned to master the new way of walking, and in the process of trying to learn, he subsequently forgot the way that he used to walk. In the parable, as a result of his folly, the man was forced to crawl his way home. It was the story of many long-term expatriates in China, those old China hands as they were once called. While never fully integrated into their adopted country, they were no longer quite at home in the places from which they came either. The man on the airplane stared at the back of the seat in front of him, his mouth pursed tight. Having thought of more I would like to say, I wanted to reopen the conversation, but there was no point in it. He was done. My return to China was bittersweet. While I reached for my seatbelt, the man next to me slipped his forearm onto the armrest between us, and there it remained for the entire 12-hour flight. Sitting with my arms folded all the way to East Asia, I wondered, how long would I have to live in China before I would be allowed to call the place home?